So here it is, the last one of the summer for me, but Rabbi Turetsky will be taking over, from what I understand. We'll be doing other amazing personalities, so I'm sure this year is going to get much, much better once you upgrade to Rav Turetsky Shlita. But for the last installment, let's talk about the Chasam Sofer. I mentioned when we were talking about the Nodav Yehuda, that it's as if the Nodav Yehuda and the Chasam Sofer were like two gifts that were given to their generation. The Chasam Sofer is a little bit earlier, the Nodav Yehuda is a little bit earlier than the Chasam Sofer, but still there were two people who were almost unquestionably the Poskei Hadar in the generations that they lived in, and their staying power in terms of the kochos of their tshuvos being used as the leading tshuvos of the Achronim that everyone looks to. The Pesukei Tshuva quotes all the time, and Rav Moshe quotes all the time, and everybody has to contend with. If you are dealing with a halacha that the Chasam Sofer, the Nodav Yehuda, or for that matter Rabbi Akiva Eiger, I guess would be the third in that group, that they've already written a tshuva on, you cannot write about it without dealing with what they said. Meaning that's how important and yesodistic they are. It would be almost like discussing a sugya where the Gemara discusses it in two places and you only deal with one of the Gemaras. It's like totally incomplete. You just can't do it. So who was the Chasam Sofer? The Chasam Sofer was born in Frankfurt am Main on September 24th, 1762. His father's name was Shmuel. His mother's name was Razel. And his mother was known as Razela Tzadekas. Why was she known as Razela Tzadekas? Apparently she went into labor on Friday afternoon, and the minhag was to be Mekabel Shabbos early. So she was going into labor as they were starting to say Kabbalah Shabbos, and she had somebody run into shul and ask the rabbi not to be Mekabel Shabbos until she had delivered. Meaning they lived in a part of the world where, like let's say you were to go to England right now in the summertime, right? So what time does Shabbos start in England in the summertime? Like 11 o'clock at night, like late. It's very late at night. So what do? So in a lot of places, they'll just be Mekabel Shabbos early every single week. They'll always do a plag Shabbos. This was a community that always made an early Shabbos. But Rezala Tzadekas was going into labor. She didn't want to have to be Mechal Shabbos to have a baby. Now, normally you can't control that. You go into labor on Shabbos. But if you can control when Shabbos is going to be, you know, so she decided to send a messenger into the shul, tell the rabbi, don't be Mekabel Shabbos. Stop everyone from being Mekabel Shabbos. Why do you have to stop everyone? Why don't you just not be Mekabel Shabbos? Because the halacha is that if you have a community that has only one shul in it, and that shul is Mekabel Shabbos, then that's binding on the entire community. This comes up very often in summer camps, and let's say you're in a camp in the mountains that's sort of secluded from other camps. It's not in the same city, not in the same village, not in the same town. It's sort of just its own little island. I remember as a kid when I was in Camp Misora, so there was nothing else near Camp Misora. It's like you go to the end of the world, you make a left, and you fall off the world, and then you land in Misora somehow, right? So it's there's nothing anywhere near there. So the halacha is that when the camp is Mekabel Shabbos, it's usher to be Mechal Shabbos, even though they're being Mechal Shabbos early. So sometimes people would drive into camp late, people who are coming for Shabbos, and it was still light outside, but Lechora, they were not allowed to drive into camp, because at that point, it's already Shabbos. So Rezala Tzadekas sends a messenger to the rabbi, stop everyone from being Mekabel Shabbos, stop Kabbalah Shabbos. So, and the rabbi listened. I don't know, she must have been a pretty big tzadekas. He gave a clap in the shul and he said, everyone, we're going to sit and learn for a little bit. and everyone listened. I mean, if a rabbi did that nowadays, he were to give a clap and say, everyone, we're going to sit and learn for a little bit, that would be his last week as rabbi, you know, in most communities. But they all listened and they sat and learned until a few hours later, another messenger came in, Mazel Tov, it's a boy, and the rabbi got up and he said, Mazel Tov, Rezal Tzadekas had a boy, and he said, I hereby declare his name should be Moshe, because somebody born under such circumstances can be a great leader of the Jewish people, like Moshe Rabbeinu, and thereby the rabbi named the baby that, I guess he earned it by holding the whole community back, and that it was the Chasam Sofer. And even as a very young child, he was very, they protected his Kedusha to an extreme degree. A legend has it, it must be documented somewhere, but I'm not a scholar, is that they would veil his face when he went out in public, until he was 3 years old, because they didn't want him to see anything impure. And that when he was about 7 years old, the Rebbe in Yeshiva translated a phrase in Bereishis, Afar min ha'adama, as God took earth from the earth. In Yiddish he said it, but Afar and Adama both mean earth, right? So he said God took earth from the earth. And he used the same word to translate both Afar and Adama. So little seven-year-old Moshe Schreiber, that was his name, asked that must mean something else, because of course you take earth from earth. What does that mean? What does that even mean? So the Rebbe didn't have an answer, so he slapped the kid, because that's what Rebbe Aim used to do when they didn't know the answer. His father took him out of school and started to homeschool him. He figured that the Rebbeim are going to stifle his genius. They're not going to nurture his... not because he was worried about child abuse. He was worried that this kid has potential. And if you tell him every time he asks an actual good kasha, you try to shut him up. That's not going to be very good. Similar story, I don't know which one is true or if they're both true, was that when he was delivering a Dvar Torah, whether it was around his bar mitzvah, or maybe before his bar mitzvah even, he was giving a Dvar Torah, and he quoted his great-grandfather or his grandfather's Sefer, and he argued, and he asked a bunch of kashas on it, and he disagreed with it. And his father got up and yelled at him, how can you do that? How can you disagree with the Zayda? Where's your kavod? So Rav Nosson Adler heard about this. Rav Nosson Adler was a great Gaon and a Kabbalist and a Tzaddik, who had a lot of unusual practices and didn't quite necessarily get along with the rabbinic establishment at his time, but you know, in hindsight, is certainly even then was recognized as a giant. Rav Nosson Adler said the father's stifling this kid too much, meaning so many. And Rav Nosson Adler said took him under his wing and asked the father essentially, let me take care of him, let him come to my yeshiva, let me teach him, and I'll train him. And he did. He essentially adopted the Chassam Sofer, except the Chassam Sofer was not a Yasam, meaning it's such an unusual thing for someone to be a genius of the level where it's almost as if everyone around him realized that you need to do something to nurture this, because this kind of greatness doesn't come along in every generation. And the Chassam Sofer became a very, very loyal Talmud of Rav Nosson Adler, as well as of the Hafla'a. Now, the Hafla'a at some point put Rav Nosson Adler in Cheirim. They didn't always get along so well. It was at a time when much of Kabbalah was very suspect, because it was in the aftermath of Shabtai Tzvi. As we mentioned before, Shabtai Tzvi was largely based on the misuse of Kabbalah. So the Hafla'a didn't like Rav Nosson Adler's overuse of Kabbalah, in his view. Eventually, they made peace, but when Rav Nosson Adler died, the Hafla'a ended up giving a hesped, gave a eulogy for him. But these were the two rebbeim of the Chassam Sofer. The Hafla'a was Rav Pinchas Halevi Yesharovitz. His Sefer is called Sefer Hafla'a, Sefer Makna as well. He has a few svarim. At the age of 13, he started the Chassam Sofer, was already giving public shiurim. Now, people tell you, don't read those biographies where they tell you that the Gadol as a child was already giving, was already teaching Gemara and whatever else. Most people it's not true about. It's correct. But there are some. There are some that were so super precocious and so advanced and so brilliant that it's true. I mean, the Vilna Gaon, the Avnei Nezer, the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer at the age of 13 was giving shiurim. His knowledge was so extraordinary that Rav Pinchas Halevi Horowitz, the Hafla'a of Frankfurt, asked him to become his Talmud, and he agreed, but he only stayed there for 1 year, and then he went to other yeshivas, and throughout his life he always considered Rav Nosson Adler and Hafla'a to be his main rebbein. Now in 1782, Rav Nosson Adler moved to Moravia, and the Chassam Sofer followed him. And in 1787, the Chassam Sofer married his first wife, who was the daughter of a rabbi of the town there. And they learned that she was, after they got married, they didn't do their research on the shidduch resume, and mostly because at that time they didn't have shidduch resumes, so they didn't know that at that time she was already a widow who didn't have children with her first husband, not by the time they get married, that would have been Mekachtos, but after their engagement, they got engaged, and then they said, oh, by the way, she's been married before, her first husband died, they were married for a few years, and they didn't have any children, which is a red flag for someone who wants to have a family. But the Chassam Sofer asked Rav Nassan Adler for advice what to do. He did not receive a response in the mail before the wedding date, so he took that as a siman min hashamayim that he's supposed to get married, and he married this woman, Sarah, even though his family was very upset about it. He was offered a whole bunch of different positions in Rabbanus. In 1806, though, he finally accepted the Rabbanus in Presburg, which is in Slovakia, and he started a yeshiva there, which became a major yeshiva. He had 500 Talmidim there, and many of them became Rabbanim throughout all over Hungary. Among his Talmidim, his main Talmidim, who are the Talmidim that comes over? Anyone know any of the main Talmidim? The Ksav Sofer, his own son, right? And the Maram Shik was also one of the main Talmidim, the Yehuda Yala. There were many others. His first wife died childless in 1812, so meaning it was true. She was married before, she was unable to have children, and apparently was not as a result of who her husband was, but based on her own inability to have children. So that was a 25-year childless marriage. Was his first marriage. So a lot of times you see with great people that they go through stuff, that they go through a lot of struggles. It's not easy for a couple to go through 25 years not married, and then she died. And then in 1813 he married his second wife, also named Sarah, and she was also an almana, and she was the daughter of Rabbi Kiva Eger. So the Chassam Sofer then became Rabbi Kiva Eger's son-in-law. The interesting thing is, the Chassam Sofer was much, much older than his second wife. The Chassam Sofer and Rabbi Kiva Eger were 2 years apart from each other. Rabbi Kiva Eger was only 2 years older than the Chassam Sofer. So can you imagine a father-in-law being like, you know, you're madrich on kol, you know, not even, right? You know, that's the age difference between them. In fact, they say that she expressed reservations about marrying him right before, you know, the wedding, and her father said, "Oh boy, we better get this wedding done quick because I don't want her to back out because he really wanted the Chassam Sofer as a son-in-law." Anyway, that marriage was a very fruitful marriage in the Pru Revu sense. They had 3 sons and 7 daughters, and he wasn't a young man to begin with, right? So 3 sons and 7 daughters. All 3 of his sons became Chashva Rabbanim, the Ksav Sofer, the Michtav Sofer, and Rav Yosef Yospa Sofer. I don't think wrote a Sefer called anything Sofer, but there were these 3 sons. The Ksav Sofer's name is Rav Avram Shmuel Binyamin Sofer, Rav Shimon Sofer is known as the Michtav Sofer, and all the descendants ended up getting Sofer names. That's why there's a Chassan Sofer, there's anything you could think of that has Sofer at the end of it. You know, people from that family are very proud of that. I mentioned the other day, the old joke went with, there was one rabbi in the family who was not quite as strong in learning, and they used to call him the Ta'u Sofer, the mistake. So his descendants would always, you know, the Shevet Sofer, the Chassan Sofer was a grandson, the Shevet Sofer was a grandson, the Yad Sofer was a great-grandson, the Das Sofer was a great-grandson, the Cheshev Sofer, the Imre Sofer, both great-grandsons. So there are a lot of Sofers.
When he did get most of the average response about whether or not...
Oh, I don't know what happened over there. The Chassam Sofer's main hashkafa that he was known for, anyone know this? Chadash Asur Min HaTovim, right? His main thing was that he led the community in Presburg for 33 years. He died in 1839, and he worked really, really hard to keep the reform movement out of Presburg. From the late 18th century and on, there were movements that developed into Reform Judaism that were starting to take root, and there were shuls that had these, synagogues that had these kinds of views, and they started popping up in Berlin and Hamburg, and he was very, very opposed to reformers and any sort of reform, and he would speak against them, and he would write against them. He ossered a shul in Vienna of you know, from doing a cantata type of a presentation or performance, because it would involve a mixed choir. He stopped the Reform Shul from opening in various communities, and his biggest opponent to a certain extent was Moses Mendelssohn, because of that, even though some sort of came after. He was known with that pun, Chadash Asmita. It's really a pun, because what does Chadash Asmita really mean? There is a halacha that the new grain from this year, you're not allowed to eat until the grain that grows in any given year, you're not allowed to eat until the Korban Omer is brought on the second day of Pesach. Or nowadays, it's a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, right? Yom Hanef Kulo Asr, till after the second day of Rosh Hashanah. But until then, what? It's in both places, I think, no? It's in Russian also. So, right, because that's the Gemara. Yeah, I think it's the Flan. So that's what the so Chadash is also min HaTorah. So that's the that's what it means in Halacha, and that's why a lot of times you'll see, you know, a Hashkacha will say Kemach Yashan or something like that, that they'll guarantee that the flower is Yashan. That's a good thing that it's Yashan, right? Meaning that means that it's more kosher if it's Yashan. It's a major question why in Chutz Laretz we don't observe the dinim of Chadash. But anyway, that's not what Chassam Sofer was talking about. He used that as an expression that anything new in Judaism is Asur min HaTorah. His primary student was probably the most notable student was the Maram Shit. And the Ksav Sofer, as we said before, and they too continued that battle against the Reform. In fact, the Chassam Sofer, if I'm not mistaken, has a tshuva where a Talmud asked if he could move to Eretz Yisrael, and he said, "Osik b'mitzvah patur min mitzvah, you're too busy fighting the Reform over here, and because you're so busy fighting the Reform, and that is the mitzvah of the day, you're patur from the mitzvah of Aliyah, of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael." No, he was a big Oy of Eretz Yisrael, actually. He was a very big Oy of Eretz Yisrael. In fact, one of his writings was censored at some point because he wrote in his Chidush Manshas in one place, I think in Masechta Shabbos, that if only I could be a farmer working the land in Israel, it would be worth everything to me. Meaning, like, what am I doing being a Rosh Hashiva and a Rav here in Freshburg? It would be better to be a farmer working the Holy Land of Israel. So he wrote something like that, so people didn't like that, so they took it out. You know, a lot of times that's, you know, there's censorship in every community. It's not just you know, the people that you think do censorship. Everybody does censorship in some way or another. I remember years ago, Rabbi J.J. Schachter wrote an article in the Torah Mada Journal about censorship, and I happened to have been eating at his house for a Shabbos lunch while he was working on the article, while he was preparing it, and he asked the people around the table if they knew of more examples of modern Orthodox censorship, where modern Orthodox people censored things because we don't like the way that it sounds. So one of the fellows at the table said, yeah, there was an example of a publication that from somewhere in modern Orthodox circles that said that when Reb Chaim died, the reason that he chose, that the Brisker Rav was chosen to be the Rabbi of Brisk and not the older son, who is the older son, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was the older son who later became Rosh Hashiva where? In YU. So the only reason the Brisker Rav was chosen was because Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was already out of town and they couldn't reach him or something like that. That's not the reason. Rav Chaim wrote very clearly that I love my son Moshe and he's a big Talmud Chacham, but my son Velvel is the one that's going to be the Rav of Brisk. You know, like it was, so that was the example that the fellow gave, that everyone knew that the Brisker Rav was going to ultimately be the Brisker Rav, meaning that that was something that that was, despite the fact that they were both such great Talmidei Chachamim. The Chassam Sofer died, as I said, in 1839, his grave is a fascinating story also. There's a memorial that has his grave and a lot of people in his family in Bratislava, and it's underground below a castle on near the Danube River. And it's like the Jewish cemetery in Bratislava was confiscated in 1943 to build like a highway, and the Jewish community, world Jewish community, had to negotiate with the regime to enable the community to preserve the section of the cemetery that had the Chassam Sofer in it. So they sort of built a highway around the grave of the Chassam Sofer in order to preserve the Chassam Sofer's grave. So his grave is like in a cave. It's like enclosed in concrete. It's below the surface of the new road. You wouldn't even know it. You'd go, if you visit the grave, you'd see these 23 large glass planks standing near each other, and then like you see this opening to a tunnel, and you go in this dark tunnel, and then there's like the remnants of a cemetery there. There's a Chassam Sofer's grave. So that's also a very interesting thing about him. Yeah. What?
They can't drive
on the highway. Probably not. I don't know. There's a pesach tefach probably underneath, which would stop the tumah. I don't know. You'd have to examine the site and be able to see the relevant halachas. Now, the Chassam Sofer had a lot of fascinating tshuvas. He also worked very hard to share the teachings of his Rebbe, because Rav Nosson Adler didn't write so much, so a lot of what we know from Rav Nosson Adler comes through the Chassam Sofer. In Tshuvas Chassam Sofer Chelik Beis in Reish Lamed Gimel, he writes, V'agav ashmi'eyu masha shemati mi peh kadosh mori v'rabi hachasut shebekuna moreno Rav Nosson Adler zatzal. That was the way he referred to him always. Like that was a modest way of referring to Rav Nosson Adler. He would always refer to him in the most glowing terms. And what he goes on to say over there is also interesting. He said that Tosos in Avodah Zarah writes that Kol Malkam Shatamotzei Har Gavoa V'Givon Nasah B'Yadua Sheyesh Sham Avodah Zarah. That in Eretz Yisrael, if you find a high mountain, then you know they must have had that the Ovdei Avodah Zarah must have had an Avodah Zarah over there. And Tosos over there writes in the name of Yerushalmi, the Mikdash Hecha Nivna L'Man Yamar Shenev B'Mechubar L'Gavoa. He says, so where, how can we build a Beis HaMikdash if every mountain has to be assumed to have housed in Avodah Zarah if you assume that those mountains become Aser? So the Yerushalmi answers that Al Pi Navi Nivne Sham, that the reason they were able to build the Beis HaMikdash was Al Pi Navi. So that the Navi said, don't worry, over here there was no Avodah Zarah, and that's why they were able to build the Mikdash. This is Yerushalmi.
Now there was a Christian church there.
Now there's a Muslim. Oh, there's a Christian church. I don't know. So he says, "Upirish Mori Zatzal Al Pi Medrash Vayaris Hamakom Erachok Shara Osamakom Emek Velohar." That Avram Avinu was walking with Yitzchak and he sees the Makom. The Makom of the Akedah was where? It was the Harabayis, right? And he sees, but he saw it was an Emek and it wasn't a Har. Vispalul Vamer Ink Vodu Shemel Lishkon VeEmek. And he said, but the covenant of the Melech shouldn't be in an Emek, it shouldn't be in a valley. V'nasa bosa yom har. And that day it turned into a mountain. Asher yomar hayom bahar Hashem yirah. That's what hayom bahar Hashem yirah. That was only that day that it was bahar Hashem yirah. V'ashi yesh lomer to kol ha'arim shemidu aleim avod zarev sh'avdom kodim sh'ritzik avram avinu alav sholom baretz. Osam nasu l'gavama. Maybe, says Rav Nosson Adler, those mountains that became Asa L'Gvah because of the Ovdei Avodah Zarah, maybe that was only those people prior to Avram Avinu's arrival. But Hara Maria was never a mountain before Avram Avinu's arrival. It was an Emek before Avram Avinu's arrival. This is the Shtikl Torah that he quotes from Rav Nosson Adler. He quotes many Shtikl Torah. In Tshuvas Chassam Sofer Chelek Beis, Yerdei Simin Ayin, Od Shemati, Kushya mimori v'rabi agon moreno rav nosson adler zatzal sheik shalom hagon shagas arye ba'avru derech the wherever the town was my nafkamina l'bnei noach bein basa minachai le'evr minachai v'yisrael yika nafkamina mashu basa gin v'atzamos av bnei noach lo nevr v'shira, meaning he records a conversation in learning. I don't know if we want to get into the details over here about the difference between Basar Menachai and Eivor Menachai, but he records a conversation that took place between his Rebbe Rav Nosson Adler and the Shagas Aryeh, one of the other great Gaonim. Rav Nosson Adler is also quoted in one of the drushos of the Chassam Sofer in Taras Emes, where he explains that there was an important lesson that was taught at Hakel. What was Hakel? So Hakel was when everyone would gather together. It was a ceremony once every 7 years where all the Jewish people would gather to hear the king read from the Torah, and even the tiniest children had to be there at Hakel. So the Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, Rabbi Elazar Chasba, went to greet Rabbi Yeshua, and they saw him, and they said, you know, Machidish Hayom Beis HaMadrash, and he said, you know, we're your talmidim. We're shosim imeimecha. We drink from your waters. So he said, no, Afal became there. Must have been a chiddush in the base medrash. So they went on to tell him that they learned that day from Levoz ben Azariah that the Torah says that hakel anoshim noshim v'taf. Well, what's the point of bringing the children to hakel if they're not going to understand anything anyway? So Levoz ben Azariah taught that the men and women come to learn and to listen respectively, and the children, what's the answer? Rashi and Chumash quoted. To give schar. So to that, Rabbi Yeshua said, "Oh, you taught me that you had this gem, this precious pearl that you could have taught me, and you withheld it from me. So it sounds a little bit funny to bring someone along for no reason. Why did the parents need to bring the children to Hakel?" So Rabbi Nosson Adler is quoted by the Chassam Sofer that there was a very important element of this. When children are there in the room, they disturb and distract from real Torah learning. It's much smarter, l'chora, to leave children, with a babysitter if you really want to be able to learn. Right? I mean, if you want to be able to daven really, really well in shul, or you want to be able to learn in the base medrash, and you have a two-year-old, even if he's on his best behavior, will be a distraction. Because on his best behavior, he's being friendly and smiley and cute. On his worst behavior, forget it. That's, you know, that normally happens on the airplane, right? On the worst behavior. That's 4 hours straight of absolute shrieking, right? So that's also a distraction. So they're always a distraction. It doesn't make sense, but the Torah wants to teach us that it's worthwhile suffering distractions and limit ourselves at times in order to help other people. And he says that's what Avraham Avinu did when he taught Torah to other people. He didn't seclude himself, even though had he secluded himself, he could have accomplished a lot more in his own growth and his own connection to the Ribono Shel Olam. But our idea of perfection comes from relating to other people and helping other people. So he thought that was the lesson of Hakel. That's what the Chassam Sofer quotes from his Rebbe, Rav Nosson Adler, and many, many other teachings as well. Let's skip some of that because we're going to run out of time. When the Chassam Sofer was a Rav in Mattersdorf, he was planning to leave to a different city, but then a fire broke out and almost every house except for his house burned down. So he felt that he had to stay to take care of the people. Because the one thing he said, a Rav's job is if other people are suffering, you cannot abandon them. Which is an interesting discussion about about whether that's true or not, whether you're allowed to leave when other people are suffering. He also was extremely generous. He gave almost everything he had to help other people. There were times that he couldn't afford the paper to write his chidushim on because he just gave everything away. He had such a heart that if someone else was in need, he just felt so badly for them that he would give up from his own. Rav Shimon Sofer writes that his father said three things about himself. That he said, from the day I was omid l'das, I never had a machshava zara during my tefillah. Think about what that means for a second. I never had a foreign thought, an alien thought during davening, meaning every time I davened, all I thought about was the tefillah, perfect concentration in tefillah. He said, right, I never felt a sense of pride, whether publicly teaching or whether making chidushim, except in his first drasha, he said, and that was to show, because I wanted to show that I could learn so that they would have proper kavod harav. And he said that he always tried to do his whole life l'shem shemayim. This is what he confided in his children as his legacy that he hoped that they would be able to carry on. He said at one point in one of his tshuvas, he was so busy and he was so in demand. Rav Shachter told us that the Chassam Sofer, his tshuvas were written like between Mincha and Maariv. Like it wasn't his main focus. His main focus was running his rabbanus, teaching his Talmidim. He had hundreds of Talmidim, fighting the reform, doing everything that he was doing. The tshuvas were written like almost kila achriyan, and that ultimately became his greatest legacy, were his tshuvas. But that was the way he was. And in one of his tshuvas, he writes that he's so busy he doesn't have time to swallow his saliva, which obviously is an expression of some sort, but I don't know if it's going to become a popular expression again. Maybe now we can start it here. I'm so busy I can't swallow my saliva. But he wrote many svarim. He wrote Torah Moshe and Chumash, he wrote Chidush Matshas, he wrote Shas and Tshuvas, he wrote Drashos Chassam Sofer, he wrote a commentary in the Chavos Al Vavos. He had a lot of very interesting halachic shitos, halachic positions. Maybe we'll go through some of them. In one tshuva in the Chassam Sofer was asked about a young orphan who was developmentally disabled. and whose relatives wanted to place him in an institution for people who suffer from disabilities, and they were hoping that he would gradually learn to live something resembling a normal life. This is way ahead of their time, right? You know, that they would, you know, to deal with people with special needs in such a way. The problem was, even though the family was capable of sending him food on a daily basis, the institution wouldn't allow any of its patients to eat outside food. That was one of their rules. They can't have any outside food. All the patients have to be part of a single community, single support system, have all their meals together. That was the rule. That's how they ran the institution. So the shaila was, are they allowed to put their child in such an institution where all the food's not going to be kosher? Can they have him eat non-kosher food? So the Chasam Sofer discusses three issues. There is the issue of chinuch, and whether you have to be mechanech the child to eat kosher food. There is the issue of losa achilum, which is pasuk in the Torah, but the Gemara darshins, that means that you're not allowed to be ma'achil isra biyadayim. If you have an isra, you're not allowed to provide the isra, to feed the isra to a child. That might be an isra, a din d'oraisa, chinuch, it's probably only drabanan. Chasam Sofer discusses both of those issues, and after deep analysis of both of those issues, comes to the conclusion that there's no problem on either count, because the child is an orphan, and the Jew is not feeding him directly, nor is he even asking a non-Jew to feed him non-kosher food. But, so on that alone, you think you're meaning, what's he going to do? He's going to be asking the institution to give medication and sustenance for the child. What kind of sustenance they give the child, that's up to the institution. Now, you know what they're going to do, but that's up to them. That's not something that you're asking of them. So, based on that, the Chasam Sofer was mekel. However, the Chasam Sofer says there's a third problem that we can't be mekel with as easily. He says that once the child becomes a bar mitzvah, he should be removed from the institution, because now he's chayiv in mitzvahs in his own right. And therefore, from a strict halachic perspective, there is a validity and a heter to leave him there till bar mitzvah, but after bar mitzvah, you have to take him out. Then the Chasam Sofer says that considering the effect of a third category called timtum alev, so we said chinuch, lo sachileim, and a third thing called timtum alev, maybe it's better to keep the child out of the institution entirely. And the Chasam Sofer quotes the Maimer Chazal, Mutav she'ashota kol yamav, v'al tia rosh hasha achas lefnei hamakom. That it's better to be a shota one's whole life rather than to be a rasha shah achas lefnei hamakom, which is a Mishnah in Maseches Edios, which is a fascinating application of that Mishnah. Because the Mishnah, anyone familiar with that Mishnah in Maseches Edios? The Mishnah tells the story of Akavya ben Mahalalel. Akavya ben Mahalalel had a child Akavya ben Mahalalel had some very unpopular positions. And the Mishnah later talks about his child, but let's stick with Akavya ben Mahalalel. He had some very unpopular positions, but he was the Gadol Adar. All the Rabbanim wanted to make him chief rabbi, they wanted to make him Rosh Hashiva, whatever the most honored position was. And they said, look, we'll make you the chief rabbi of everything. All you got to do is you have to change three of your positions. You have to change just three of your opinions. And he says, and he responded, Mutav she'ashota kol yamai, that I'd rather be considered a fool my whole life, not to be a Rosh Hashah achas lefnei hamakom. The Ribbono Shel Olam knows that I have to do what my honest to goodness opinion is, and I can't change my opinion. Rav Shechter was once offered a prestigious rabbinic position, and they said, you just have to drop the Zionist stuff. Mutav she'ashota kol yamai, v'al tia rosh hashah achas lefnei hamakom. So obviously, an honest person doesn't do that. The end of that Mishnah, by the way, says that that when Akavya ben Mahalalel was dying, his son came to him, and his son said, should I follow your positions, your shitos? And he said, no. And he said, well, why not? You gave up, you know, being the chief rabbi of the world, you know, to defend these positions. And he said, yeah, but I heard, you know, I heard it from my rebbeim, who at the time were the majority. But it seems that the majority has shifted. So you have to follow the majority and not follow me. So you should follow the majority opinion. So even though it was something he was willing to give up a significant benefit for, but nevertheless, he didn't tell his children to to follow suit. Another major halachic position was about secular dates, using secular dates, which is again part of Chadash Asim in HaTorah. But in Drashos Chassam Sofer, he argues that by counting our years back to the creation of the world, we're reminding ourselves of the Ribbono Shel Olam and of our right to Eretz Yisrael. When one uses a secular date, they're implying that Ein Lanu Chelek B'Elokei Yisrael, and they've become their Moes with the Torah Hashem. And he says in his commentary to Parshas Bo that the Torah tells us to consider HaChodesh Zelechem Rosh Chodashim, which means that you have to consider Nisan to be the first month, and that's there to remind ourselves of the Yetzias Mitzrayim, and not to, God forbid, like the counting of the nations of the world that count to other things. So he thought that we have to be very makbid, and followers of Chassam Sofer, you know, on the tombstone sometimes you'll see both dates. You'll see the Hebrew date and also the secular date. The followers of Chassam Sofer would not put the secular date. I don't know how they would write a check or whatever else, or fill in government papers or stuff like that. I guess if they had to, they had to. But generally speaking, they tried to avoid it. One final position of Chassam Sofer, then I got to run to the airport. The Chassam Sofer, because everyone keeps scaring me about how terrible the lines are in the airport, and that I'm going to miss the flight. So I'm going to miss our chavrusa. But the Chassam Sofer writes that about mechitza. He says that one has to be very, very careful in of having a mechitza that's absolutely iron tight. He says, "Vine anu musarim l'shma kol zemerish isha afilu pnuya shein anida ve'erva b'shas shanu karm kriyash v'b'shas tefila." He said, "The halach is in Shulchan Aruch that during shas kriyash man tefila you're not allowed to say dvarim shebekedusha when there's kol isha. So even if she's not a nida and even if she's single, because if she's an eshes ish or a pnuya, that's a nida. So then even if weren't shas kriyash man tefila, it would be asur because kol be isha erva. So even if she's a pnuya tahor." Or even, it would still be Asr B'Shas Kriyash of Tefillah. He says, "We believe Shakol Tefillah Ushevach V'Odah Shemesari V'Machshava Hi Shum Hirhur Afilu B'Ishto Lotala B'Malos Fnei Hashem Yisparach Lo Tekuba Lefanav." That a Tefillah that has Hirhurim Ra'im mixed in during the Tefillah is not going to be accepted by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. U'mneza Anu Mafrishma Nashmin HaNashmi Sakneses. He says, that's why Mechitza is so important in Shul. Why is he making such a huge deal about Mechitza in Shul? Because what were the reformers doing? Trying to take down the mechitza in the shul. Where in Shulchan Aruch does it say that you need a mechitza in the shul?
Nowhere.
It's one of those halachas. It does not appear in Shulchan Aruch. Good question, why not? But it does not appear in Shulchan Aruch. So Chassam Sofer writes that it's so important. Shelo yavo lidei hir b'shas tefila v'tiyat tefila nitches rachmana litzlan v'yatzal al hazeh misimchas beis hashoeva. Where do I know this from? From the Gemara at the end of Sukkah about simchas beis hashoeva, because it says that they made a takana that nashim milamayla va'anashim milamata shelo yavo lidei kalus rosh, that the women would be in a balcony and the men would be on the ground floor, so that it wouldn't come to kalus rosh. And where did they get that idea from? Because the pasuk in Zechariah says, "V'safta aretz mishpachos levad, mishpachos beis dav levad, noshoseim levad." So Amru, they said that if in the time of Hesped of the Mashiach ben Yosef, that the men and women have to be separated, and at a time of Hesped, there's not really much of a Yetzer Hara. So at a time of Simcha, like the Simchas Beis Hashoeva, al achas kama v'kama. So he says, "Umizeh ra'il anal." Tafilu echad lekum yishum isra erva kagon ishto shel atzmo. Even when there's no erva, it's your own wife. Mikol makom b'makom tefila v'hodah o hesped kol ma debayi libar l'rachmana lo yisara shum inyan hirur afilu b'ishto amru sharei k'siv b'shvach space dav levad v'nosheyem levad. The pasuk in Zechariah says not men and women, men and their wives had to be separated, and he's emphasizing this. No family seating in shul, no men and husbands and wives sitting next to each other in shul, because again, this was big. The conservative movement pushed this after the Chassam Sofer's time. The family that prays together stays together, right? That was the saying. And the Chassam Sofer said, no, the family shouldn't pray together. The women should be in an Ezra's Nashim, they should be in the balcony. And then he said, and besides for that, since Kol B'Isha Erva, the Kol is Mishalich, Mi Ezra's Nashim, Ezra's Nashim, it's going to be more here, and Bitla Kavana. And that would be unfortunate. And therefore, he suggests that it should be done in such a way where it's where you wouldn't even be able to hear the sounds of women singing along in the tefillah or anything like that. So he had a lot of very, very fascinating tshuvas. This is just a very small sampling and not really indicative of the vastness of his his work, but okay, we're out of time, so we're going to stop there. Everyone, enjoy the rest of the summer. I mean, Tisha B'Av, you should have a meaningful Tisha B'Av. Beis Hashem, you should be able to celebrate at the Kotel this year, but certainly enjoy the rest of the summer and all the learning. Thank you very much for